Welcome to Wheels Across the West, History and Legacy of the Santa Fe Trail, a podcast produced by students at the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri and presented by the Missouri Humanities Council. I'm Kyle Jackson, Santa Fe Trail Fellow at Kinder, and your host for today's episode, The Missouri Mule, Lodestar of the American West.
The mules is all that they use in the hunting country, because they are sure-footed. When a man gets on one, that mule's going to stay on his feet unless something accidentally really happened.
And then he said, I'll trade you this tractor for that four-headed mules there that you got on the desk. I said, I wouldn't trade the mules for all the tractors you got.
My grandfather was absolutely convinced that the work animal was the mule.
We like to ride them for fun, you know. We like to see them buck.
That's a good quality mule.
Oh, yeah, they were number one Missouri mules.
At that time, that's where most of the mules in this country were going. They didn't want horses, they wanted mules. So they would last longer, really. Could stand the heat better.
And I said, have you got some pretty good mules? He said, the best. And I said, well, you sure as hell need them if you work this land, because it's tough. He said, don't talk to me about tough land. He said,
what made the Missouri mule such an important part of the state's history and identity? That's the question that Mizzou professor Melvin Bradley set out to answer in the early 1980s with the Missouri Mule Oral History Project that you just heard clips from. Professor Bradley interviewed over 100 people connected in some way with working, buying, breeding, raising, riding, and trading mules in the state. The interviews were mostly with old-timers who had witnessed the modernization of agriculture beginning in the early 20th century. Some of his subjects had been born as early as the 1880s, a time before tractors and trucks and Model T Fords changed the nature of farm work forever. They had lived through the Great Depression and the booms and busts surrounding two world wars. They'd seen Missouri ship literally millions of mules throughout the country and across the world. Many of them described how their mules were considered part of the family, how these animals connected them to their parents and grandparents and a wider community. They explained how mules were a symbol of a world that seemed to be fading away, and how they felt about losing that piece of the past. When I started listening to these tapes that Professor Bradley donated to the State Historical Society of Missouri, I didn't know much about mules, or rural life in general, to be honest. I'm a city slicker from Oakland, California. I've never lived more than a mile from a 7-Eleven. Before moving to Columbia to work as the Santa Fe Trail Fellow, I barely ever set foot in the Midwest, much less explored the country roads of the American heartland.
Okay, we're in business. Looks like that. Working just fine.
When I loaded in the first cassette and pressed play, it felt like stepping into a time machine. The people who spoke were incredible fountains of knowledge and memory. They told the good professor about their childhoods, their marriages, hard lessons they had learned from shady salesmen, love and loss and changes in the land. Mostly, they talked about work. All the hard work they had done, how much money they had made and lost, what made life easier or harder as time went on.
In other words, the mules had a very important, rough job to do, and they did get the job done.
It became clear as I listened to the tapes and chatted with locals that Missourians really do have a special connection to the mule. In 1995, Governor Mel Carnahan signed a bill designating the Missouri mule as the official state animal. If you look closely at Mizzou's MU logo, you'll see an outline of the face of that long-eared offspring of a horse and a donkey, the draft animal that many historians argue built the American West as we know it. And, as you may have guessed by now, the origins of the Missouri mule go all the way back to one of the most important developments of the state's early history, the establishment of the Santa Fe Trail.
Thank you. geographical location was first. Here was Franklin, over here on the river. There wasn't any Boonville in 1820. And here is William Becknell that had a farm. All right, Becknell took two or three pack horses. There were no mules in Missouri prior to that time. You probably knew it. There's no record of any mules in Missouri prior to 1820.
In 1821, the year Missouri became a state and Mexico achieved independence from Spain, a party of traders led by William Becknell first opened up the overland trade route that would become the Santa Fe Trail. Setting out with a small party from Franklin, Missouri on September 1st, Becknell and his companions learned along the way that Mexico was independent and open for business with American merchants for the first time. They arrived in Santa Fe in late December and returned in late January with a bounty of silver, blankets, donkeys, and mules. The silver pesos caught the attention of the public, but the arrival of the Spanish or Mexican mule would prove to be just as consequential. A few months later, in May 1822, Becknell went back down the trail for his second expedition, this time with three wagons in tow. Again, he returned to Missouri with silver and mules. Word spread fast that an abundant source of these valuable draft animals was available in the West. Every New Mexico party in those early years came back with more mules and donkeys. In 1823, a group led by Stephen Cooper returned from Santa Fe with 400 Jackson, Jennets, and mules. These provided the initial stock for the mule industry in Missouri. As trade along the Santa Fe Trail continued to accelerate, the steady influx of animals from the Southwest helped the state become the mule trading capital of North America. Over the next few decades, it would also become the largest breeding state. Breeding the smaller Mexican Jack and Jennet stock with larger horses and mares from Tennessee and Kentucky, the nimble and rugged Missouri mule was born.
That was free range from here to Cape Girardeau, plumb to the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's free range in there.
Horses, hogs,
everything.
All run together, didn't
they? Everybody had a good jack. My dad would have as high as three or four good jacks. That's what bit my thumb off right there. See that thumb?
I'd like to own a jack. The earliest Santa Fe traders used the smaller Mexican mules mostly as pack animals. Huge parades of hundreds of mules and horses made attractive targets for powerful indigenous nations of the southern plains like Comanches and Apaches. By the time the Santa Fe Trail became a major commercial highway, the region's native economies and cultures increasingly revolved around raiding and trading for animal wealth.
James Josiah Webb, 1846. The Apache Indians would steal mules in the state of Chihuahua and sell them in New Mexico, and they would get into the hands of the traders, and on arriving in El Paso would be reclaimed by the agents who held the brands of many haciendas to prove the ownership. The animals stolen by Indians strayed from the owners, unlawfully disposed of by the Mexican servants and laid to Indians or other thieves, combined to make a large portion of the mules in New Mexico rather insecure property.
As the caravans grew and wagons became the preferred method for freighting, merchants realized that mule teams were better suited to the task than horses. Mules could endure the harsh conditions of the Southwest better. They didn't spook as easily. They could cross rushing rivers and navigate rocky cliffs. By the mid-19th century, wagon trains on the growing network of overland trails were almost exclusively pulled by mules or oxen. But mule teams were the preferred engines of the Santa Fe Trail.
Josiah Gregg, 1845. About half of the wagons in these expeditions have been drawn by oxen. They possess many advantages, such as pulling heavier loads than the same number of mules, particularly through muddy or sandy places. But they generally fall off in strength as the prairie grass becomes drier and shorter, and often arrive at their destination in a most shocking plight. In this condition, I have seen them sacrifice at Santa Fe for $10 the pair. Therefore, although the original cost of a team of mules is much greater, the loss ultimately sustained by them is usually less, to say nothing of the comfort of being able to travel faster and more at ease.
Traders found that freighting was far from the only work that mules could thrive in. Well into the 20th century, Missouri sent thousands of mules to the south to work on cotton and sugar and tobacco plantations.
Cotton mules, they called them. Black men, you know, was working those mules, and work them with
plow that cotton with a double shovel plow. It is quite a deal, quite a sight to see it.
Mules also worked in the mountains and the forests hauling timber.
Well, I can remember plumb back whenever the loggers was back in these hills here, and everybody worked mules. And my dad would buy a pair of mules and sell to them, or if they got a mule crippled, he'd buy that mule, straighten it up, and resell it to another logger. That went on for years in there, you know.
They worked underground in the mining industry.
They knew how to squat down. Every now and then the rock would bear down on a strap. They were 8 foot long and 3-bayed oak. They'd bear down. They knew where they were at, though, because they were smart enough to do that. And there was some slope in a mine. I mean, it fell the natural contour of the earth to an extent, not as pitched as the outside was, but it followed it to an extent. Well, all the mines that I've talked about used mules. All the Novinger field used mules.
They helped build roads and railroads.
Where was this first road built?
Right north of Jackson, up here where that little motel is. That's where I started first and built 2 miles in 1922, pretty near to the intersection of I-55. And then in 1923, I built from there to Appleton, graded it all. And all that work there, I never had any tractors or nothing but mules. Mules and men and dynamite, had a little dynamite.
They served as essential workers on small family farms and sharecropping operations.
Of course, we farmed with horses and mules for years. We never owned a tractor till in the 40s. We worked with horses and mules for years and years and farmed a lot more in those days and with those than we did even after we got a tractor or two.
They also played vital roles in the military. Hundreds of thousands of mules were used in the Civil War. Missouri shipped thousands of them at the turn of the century to serve in Great Britain's Boer War in South Africa. They sent millions more overseas during World War I and World War II. Missouri mules marched through Burma, the Philippines, and everywhere the U.S. Army went.
During the war now, when they shipped all of these mules out, none of them returned to Missouri. And it was such, I just wonder how many left Missouri during World War I.
About 1.5 million.
A million and a half. And none of them returned.
It took 6 mules to carry 1 artillery gun. We had 75 howitzers. It took 6 mules, break the gun down, and 6 mules.
One officer, I heard him say, or he told a story about a fellow that was bringing the ammunition to the front on his mule, leading him, and they were shooting at the mule, and he didn't pay too much attention. He just kept coming on towards the front. Finally got close enough, and one of the officers hollered at him and said, "Hide that damn mule!" Said he's a drawing fire.
Everything I read by historians and everything I heard in the oral history interviews convinced me that mules had played a crucial role in American history. But I wanted to see for myself what a Missouri mule could do. So I reached out to a local expert, Les Clancy, who offered to take me for my first ride. Les Clancy is something of a legend in the mule industry. He runs the annual Ozark Mule Days Festival, which brings together mule trainers, traders, and enthusiasts from across the country and around the world. He also created the Missouri Mule Makeover Competition, where some of the best trainers around take an unbroken steed and have 150 days to transform it into a praiseworthy show mule. Sounds like it would be a great reality show.
So did you grow up with mules?
Yep, my whole life. I grew up on a farm just about 15 miles south of here. It was called Boys Town of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was the farm manager for the group home, and I lived on there, and horses and mules were therapy for boys. It's called Boys and Girls Town now, but back in the day, it used to be just Boys Town. And so, yeah, all through high school, I didn't really have a job. I had one job, believe it or not. I worked at Dairy Queen for a while, and when I was about 13, I realized this ain't for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and I worked for the ranch and broke mules, broke wagon teams, worked with boys, trained a lot of horses, and partied.
Les is also connected to the long history of mules in the military. He served in the U.S. Army for 27 years, and he told me that pretty much everywhere he went, his mule went with him.
So this mule here is, his name's Luke. Cool, his real name was Cool Hand Luke at the time. Well, I was in the Army because he went with me. He went where I went.
I think I have Luke's military order here.
Wow.
So that is from Congress that inducted my mule and gave him the rank of corporal.
His barn, which he calls a work in progress, reflects a lifetime and a lineage of a mule man.
Don't look at the mess. I've still been
he has an impressive collection of trophy saddles representing victories in mule shows in counties and states across the country. On the walls hang posters and metallic signs and all sorts of mule-related ephemera, vintage spurs and harnesses, even an antique champing bit from the Civil War era. Faint country music plays on a radio in the barn as we load up the trailer behind his truck with three gorgeous mules, Josie, Sadie, and Oakley.
This is your steed for the day. That is Sadie. All right. We'll walk out. We'll load.
I'll be riding Oakley, named for Annie Oakley, the famous sharpshooter portrayed in the musical Annie Get Your Gun. I'm nervous. I've never ridden before.
Your mule, Oakley, that's her name, Oakley.
Huh?
Oakley is my good mule. I team rope on her. I work. Yeah, that's my working mule. So if a cow got out on the interstate and someone called me, hey, we got to go catch cattle, that's the mule I go get.
Hmm. Yeah. What do you do? You said you work at the stockyards. Mm-hmm. What do you do there?
We push cattle every week. We sell. Like this week, we sold 26.
After riding down Highway 63 towards Rolla, Missouri, we exit and drive towards the edge of Mark Twain National Forest. As we barrel down the country road to a property owned by Les's uncle, he tells me about how the area has changed through the years, how the mule business went from a joke in the 1980s to a big business again in recent years with the growing popularity of trail riding. He also tells us why he's packing a pistol, which I have to admit was a little startling.
So you're not alarmed, but I do take a pistol. The farm, the big ranch that we're going to, has got a ton of armadillos, and they're bad.
Really?
And the biggest thing that they're doing here is an armadillo, you know, they're blind. So they feel around by their smell and their touch, but they're really fast. Is they have just about decimated our quail and our turkey population because they eat eggs. So I give it my due diligence servants to the state of Missouri that I'm going to help with the eradication of armadillos.
Interesting.
Les and his friend Jay assure me and my fiancée Rachel that we have nothing to worry about.
Check on them stirrups and then we'll pull out.
All right. Then just
grab
go for
that horn. Be a cowboy.
All right.
Can you stand up and put a fist underneath your groin?
I put my left boot in the stirrup, swing my right leg over the top, and suddenly I feel like a cowboy. I get a little lecture on the basics of steering.
Like you don't even have to pull back.
Pull left, she goes left.
But then
pull right,
back,
she goes right.
Squeeze your feet.
Pull back, she stops. It's all pretty simple. And before I know it, we're off down the trail under a beautiful mid-Missouri blue sky.
Yep.
When you were pulling back, you didn't have your hands even. You were pulling back.
We ride about 5 miles around the property, across rivers, up a ridge into the national forest. Along the way, Les and Jay tell us stories. They both grew up riding from just about the time they could walk. I could tell how much the land and the mules meant to them, how many memories revolved around them. But it's not just something from the past for them. We still ride together several times a week. Les breaks mules, sells them, works them down at the stockyard, ropes and rides at rodeos, shows them at fairs and festivals. Jay likes to go coon hunting on the mules. They often go out west to Colorado to hunt big game and ride.
Jay, I cannot believe we have not seen an armadillo. I mean, they might be up in the woods when we hit the trail.
They tell us to keep our eyes peeled for armadillos and sheds, deer antlers that the bucks discard at a certain time of year. Eventually, Les spots an armadillo and decides this is the moment to get his mule used to the sound of gunfire. Still in the saddle, he fires off into the underbrush.
All right.
His mule immediately bucks, sending his hat and pistol flying, though he manages to stay on. It got pretty western there for a minute, Jay jokes. After calming his mount, Les proceeds to fire off a full clip, each shot causing my mule, Oakley, to flinch. Sadie, Rachel's beautiful steed, doesn't even bat an eyelash.
Felt like I was in a Remington painting.
Throughout the trail ride, I'm struck by how sure-footed the mules are, how confident they are navigating tough terrain, how carefully they follow our instructions. All the descriptions I'd heard in the oral histories about how smart and dependable mules are seemed to me to be completely true.
Over the river and through the woods.
After a little trek up and down a ridge, across a couple streams, past the old schoolhouse and some gravestones from the 1840s, we round back to the parking lot to find our trucks surrounded by a herd of cattle. Les rides ahead and drives them off. Apparently Rachel's mule is afraid of cows. We dismount, load up the trailer, and say our goodbyes. Quite an adventure for a greenhorn dude like me.
What a treat.
Yeah.
Some special animals.
Yeah, they're something. Crazy what they can do and endure.
Yeah.
You like her?
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Sandy.
Just like the oral histories, my first mule ride allowed me to time travel. It put me in touch with the nearly universal experience of the early American West. Straddled on top of Oakley, I felt connected to the millions of riders before me. I tried to imagine what it would be like to be on the Santa Fe Trail, barreling ahead into the unknown, entrusting your life to a beast of burden. It must have been nice to have a sturdy companion. Of course, Americans have never been the rugged individualists we claim to be. Every step of the westward way, mules have been there to share the load. This episode of Wheels Across the West is written, narrated, produced, and engineered by me, Kyle Jackson. Our executive producer is Jay Sexton, director of the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri. This podcast is recorded at KBIA Studios in Columbia and distributed in partnership with the Missouri Humanities Council. Our theme song and additional music by Fog Holler. I've been up, I've been down, I've been lost, I've been found, I am so gosh darn confused.